Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 5, for Autumn Semester 2017. Lecture 5, delivered on September 5, 2017. The title of this lecture is Financial Statements.
Tonight, Financial Statements. Now, first things first, I'm going to give you some information, some website that you can go to, especially one, where you can get financial and other information about companies that is in very useful form, and it will do you good not just for this class, but for classes you'll take after this one. This is the kind of information and data that can get you through term papers, it can get you through reports and such assignments as that, a lot easier than if you are clawing for data, looking every which way. The reason this data is so useful and so valuable is because this is SEC reporting data. Companies have to tell the truth. They have to give the complete picture in this information. Now, to begin with, I talked about corporations, which is what we mostly talk about in this class, corporations. Now, there are two flavors of corporations. There are private corporations, and there are public corporations. The distinction being that when we say a public corporation, they have done something that makes it so that they are subject to securities laws at the federal level. Specifically, as I had mentioned before, the Securities Act of 1933 and the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. Public companies have access to the public capital markets. That's the upside of it. The downside is that forever after that, they have to file all of these papers. And I mean, when I was a consultant, I would often, most of the time, I would be put in contact with a company, a small company, that wanted to raise money through the capital markets. They wanted to do a stock offering, for example. And I would first have to explain to them, make it clear to them, that if you do this, this means that you will have access to all that money. You can go in and invite investors to invest in your company publicly, but forever after that, you have to file all these reports all periodically, and sometimes things that are not periodic, but you still have to file them. Decisions you make might have to be revealed to the SEC so that they can post it publicly. A private company doesn't have to do any of that. A private company doesn't have to tell all of this information, make these filings, get them on time. The downside of it is simply that you can't go and just simply say, please buy some stock in my company. That would be a violation of securities law, and you would very likely get fined and possibly go to prison for doing it. Private companies do produce a lot of financial information, mostly for their private investors. Wealthy people, these angel investors and all of this kind of stuff, private equity funds. And so these investors aren't stupid. They're going to say, we want to see your financial statements. So they still have to prepare all of this information, just like a public company does, maybe sometimes even more, because the investors are going to want to walk, the potential investors are going to want to walk in there and have a look around. But they don't have to tell it to everyone. They don't have to put it up on websites where anyone in the world can see it. There were times, it was kind of a mixed bag. There were companies that did have enough of a decent idea that I could take them to private investors, the angels, or the hawks, something like that. But though it was never the case. They wanted to meet these officers and directors of the company personally. Oftentimes, they wanted a seat or a big say in the direction and decisions of the company. They wanted to walk around the facilities and all that kind of stuff. So there was the upside that this was all private, but the downside was these investors were going to want to look at everything that was going on. Now that the statute of limitations is over, I can tell you that there were games that were played with private companies, especially when I was involved in oil and gas exploration and exploitation. What we would often do is we would want to drill for oil somewhere. We wanted to do a wildcat. We needed the money for it to rent the rig. We wanted to get the money together for all of the other equipment, the roughnecks we needed to hire and all that kind of stuff. So what we would do is we would go north into the less astute investor community of people who had a lot of money. And we would play them. We would talk to them man to man about being involved in oil and gas and all that kind of stuff. We'd show them a good time with steaks and talk about the roughness of being out there in the oil patch and get them to maybe sometimes take them out there and let them look at big equipment, let them sit down someplace that where there were noisy machines. So there was that kind of private investment where you were gaming a little bit with people who were not particularly astute. But we were not in violation of any laws, per se. But in the end, these guys usually didn't win. Even if we won, they'd come out on top. But if we were in a bad position, they lost a lot more than we did in the play. That having been said, and I'm talking here waiting for the sun to go down enough so that you can see this idiotic board. Unless one of you wants to pull those windows, can one of you back there pull those screens down a little ways so I haven't got this sun in my eye? Thank you very much. Now, while I'm while that's going on, for the most part, you will analyze public companies, and they will have a lot of information on them in your academic work, especially. You will probably, well, I shouldn't say this, possibly you'll go to work for a public company. You can do research on these companies through the facilities I'm going to show you tonight. And that kind of helps you know whether this is a match for you. And it also helps you go into interviews with a better idea of what's going on in the company. Truth of the matter is that the data that we collect, what we understand about companies, is much more tilted toward the public companies. These are like a black hole. We can't see in them, so we really don't know what they're in, everything from how they are managed to what their finances are like exactly. They are sort of like something that is not in the typical information that we report summarily in statistics. We know a lot about public companies. We know much less about private companies. Now, some private companies will let researchers go in and look at them for research papers, but that's kind of a biased sort of data set because it's the private companies that are doing well that are more likely to show us what they're doing than the private companies that are not doing so well or are doing secretive things that they don't want us to know about. So there you are. Let me show you something here. This is the very useful for you to know. I'm going to use first things first. Put this in your notes, sec.gov. I may have already shown you this, but it's important for you to see it here. This is the Securities and Exchange Commission's front page, the front end of it. Now, filings, if you go under filings and go to company filing search, you go to the upper tab. Yeah. Oh, I'm just testing you. See, there. Fine, if you want to see it. Really? Oh, wow. Okay, sec.gov. Just type in sec.gov and it'll take you there. This is the front page. And now, under filings, go to let's try that again. That jumped fast. Let me do that one more time. Under filings, go to company filing search. Now, be cautious. Typing in the name of a company can be a bad idea because a number of companies can have the same name, and you won't know which one it is that you need to pull up. I show you an example here, a great example. Watch what happens when I type in Sears. Sears. Oh, my, look at all those companies. I mean, all those CIKs, all those companies. You don't know which one it is that you want to look at. That's not a good idea. It's better to have the trading symbol. And to do that, I mean, there are a lot of different places you can get it. I usually just go to Yahoo Finance, finance.yahoo.com. I know a lot of them by heart, but it never hurts to check. And let me type in Netflix. There you go, Netflix, NFLX. There's its trading symbol right there. And then I can put that over into the fast search. And there I have it. And there we are with the Netflix filings. Now, first things first. The big 800-pound gorilla is their annual filing on Form 10-K. Below that, they file quarterly updates on 10Q. We call these the Qs and Ks. They are your primary research vehicles, and they are comprehensive. The 10K is the one we'll look at. This one's going to be out of date. It was filed last year at the end of their last fiscal year last year. I think it was in October, early October of last year, they filed their 10K. And there's been a Q that's come since then. But every research analyst, as soon as those are filed, we are plowing down into those documents as fast and hard as we can to see what they say. Because they have qualitative information and quantitative information. Now, there are a couple others here, and I think I already mentioned these to you. But these are actually kind of important. See these 8Ks? The Qs and Ks, the 10K and the 10Qs, have to be filed repeatedly, cyclically, always. Now, there are some events that are not recurring. There's special things that happen. The 8Ks are where they tell the public something happened. You're the president of Big Corp International. You die. Well, that's an 8K filing. It's a non-recurring event. You're not going to die twice. You, sir, are the... you were the CFO and you were abducted by aliens. Well, I'm going to report that. I mean, it's a non-recurring event. Once in a lifetime. Now, cows have it happen to them much more often, so I don't know if I'd file an 8K for a cow, you know. But for you, it's kind of unusual to happen. So an 8K. As I had mentioned before, I think, some of these small corporations would do this pump and dump game. They would issue a press release telling some incredible thing that was happening in the company, and then that would pump the stock price up, and then the insiders would dump their stock, or their friends would dump their stock on the high, and then the stock price would collapse again. Every time they issued a press release, I would file an 8K. And so it was a decent source of income for me, just cranking out these quick little documents. This press release was published on this date, just to inform the public that had happened. Company, I won't go into it, but that was rather a common thing back in the day. They've tightened up things like that, but you still have to be careful about those press releases, especially from little tiny corporations trying to get interest generated in their stock. But anyway, there are some in here like insider trading filings. Insiders are allowed to sell and buy stock. It's just that they have to do it at certain times. Like, they can't sell stock right before they give out a bad financial report. But there are windows and limits on what they can sell or buy, and there are these documents in here that would disclose, okay, these 144s? If you see 144, that's probably some notice of a sale of stock or an issuance of stock by or to insiders. So, I mean, you can just plow through these, but keep your eye on Qs and Ks, and the 8Ks included. Now, I'm going to find their 10K, and probably the easiest way to do that is to type in 10K. And say go. Okay, here we go. This is the 10K. It's got two parts. One, I'm just going to quickly show you. Don't go crazy over this. This is the primary main monster document. It is full of information. It is a huge, it is book length for any decent sized corporation. And what they say in there is actually quite glib and quite honest. They can't lie in these. And they have sort of a tendency, there's been a historical tendency to be quite honest in their analysis. They'll do an analysis of their own financials. They'll do an analysis of what's happened with the company. So this is an incredibly powerful source for information about companies. It's called a primary source. Unlike some ridiculous thing like Wikipedia, this is an original source, the company's words. From the company's mouth to your eyes. This is the document, and if you cite this one and quote from it in a term paper, it is unassailable as a statement, what you have said, what you have written. This is a monster. Look at this. This is what I used to do. This is where I made my decent sort of continuing income. And it is something that you have to do every year, and the Q equivalent of that every quarter once you're a public company. Look at this monster. I mean, it's just all over the place. Numbers, analysis, footnotes, references by inclusion, references by citations by reference. But it also gives you exact name of the company, where it is, a lot of meat in there. And I'll talk about this more as time goes on. But this is an incredible resource, and it's great for your research papers. But enough of that. Let me not do that. I'm going to show you this. This is the wonderful thing. Going back to where I saw the original documents and the 10Ks, the interactives. This gives you all of the financial statements. Statement of earnings. Now, here's the first thing that's important for you to watch out. Companies use different words for the same things. One company might call it the income statement. Another company might call it the profit and loss statement. Another company might call it the consolidated statement of operations. They're all the same thing. It's even worse than that because once you get into the document, different companies will use different words for the same thing. And companies anymore, they'll actually exclude lines that they don't have to report. That's kind of important to us here in a little bit. But here's the jackpot. Every company has to provide it in Excel form. All of their financial statements, all there, you can generate your charts, your graphs for any kind of report you want to write, term paper. It's all right here. They've already done the hard work, and all you have to do is find the data that you want to make a little pretty chart and then export it to your term paper. It's all here. One problem, though. Watch this. This is how much has to be reported. All of these sheets are required reporting. One after the other, 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 after the other. It will blow your mind. What I do, and this is cheating to a certain extent, but it's something I would recommend you do. If you're using this kind of stuff, I quickly delete everything that I don't need need. I can get it back. I can re-download it if I accidentally get rid of something I might need. But usually what I need is the income statement. I also need the balance sheet. And I'll also need the statement of cash flows. And I also probably would like to have the notes to the financial statements, because those notes can carry a lot of explanations of numbers that might not make sense if you look at the balance sheet on it or the income statement on its own. It's important that you kind of keep an eye on those notes, because there's that one financial statement that hardly anyone teaches you about. Now, plowing through, I'm going to expand this a little bit here so that you can see this better. Let me just make this bigger. I'm looking for the income statement. Did I already miss it? Seriously? Wait. Let me go clear back to the beginning. Okay, there's the document entries. I missed it right off the bat. There's your income statement. They call it the consolidated statement of operations. And keep in mind that this is in thousands. So in Netflix's case, those top lines are billions of dollars. Okay? Now, there are a couple of things you want to do real quick as soon as you see this document right here. I'm going to put in a line, insert a row right below cost of revenues. They don't have to report this anymore, but it's something that's important to know. Gross income. Now, what that gross income is, it's your revenues equals... Whoops, didn't mean to do that. It's your revenues equals revenues minus your cost of goods sold. And then I'm going to copy that over. Here's what that line means. Cost of revenue. Those are costs that are directly and definitely related to a dollar of sales, to your sales. In my business, for example, as a professional artist, I will have something that I'm selling at an art show. Sell it for $700. Okay, some of the cost of that, I can't really say that cost is right there in that. My gas cost, my opportunity cost, my time, my equipment, stuff like that, my bills for my internet websites and all of those. I can't directly attribute those to that right there, but there are some that I can. The frame, the museum glass, the dry mount, the mat, those I can say, right, that comes to, let's say, $230 to put that up for sale. That is a cost of goods sold. That's what would be on this line. Think of this as like your wholesale cost. So when I take revenues minus cost of revenues, or cost of goods sold as it's called sometimes, I'm talking about how much money survived from wholesale to retail. That's what that means. Now there's another thing that I'm going to do here too. I'm going to insert a column. And here's what this column is going to do. And this is a formula that is hugely important. It's a simple arithmetic formula that's not emphasized nearly enough in business school. It's a percent change formula. Percent delta is always an ending value minus a beginning value over all of that divided by the beginning value. It tells you the period-to-period percent change, because that's all we really care about. We don't care about dollar changes so much. We care about percentage changes. So watch what happens. See, do you see? Netflix clearly fiscal year over fiscal year, you see that the revenues have been increasing. Well, that's good, but what about the percent change? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to say equals the open parenthesis, the end value minus the beginning value, all divided by the beginning value. And then I'm going to turn that into a percentage, format the cell. And typically, I mean, your problems for the in the online work, say 3 decimal places, 5 decimal places. In practice, I like to use 2 decimal places as a starting point. Now, wherever you, try that again. 2 decimal places. Now, wherever you work, if you do a quantitative, there's going to be a house rule, a house policy. Well, you always put 2 decimal places or 4 decimal places. You know, whatever. Okay, so I'm going to then copy this, and I'm going to paste it over here. So we can see now that, yes, revenue did rise, but more importantly, what do you notice about the percentage change? Go.
Increasing.
Yes, there's an acceleration. That makes me happy. Sometimes I get a little worried. Background. This is why you should take a class from me, because I'll give you some deep background. You can, if a company just keeps accelerating its growth, all the analysts say, "Wee, that's wonderful! How exciting!" But sometimes a company is increasing its revenues, and it's not really doing it in the right way. You'll have companies that will be they'll be obsessed with growing their revenue base, but they will not be keeping up with it with respect to the infrastructure of the company. Yeah, it's wonderful that a company just keeps growing at an accelerating rate, but are they burning up their hardcore fixed assets in the process? I mean, we've got many examples of companies that look great. As far as their revenues went, they were containing their costs incredibly. But what they were doing is they were not putting any new investment, repairing, looking for new technologies on their fixed assets, and ultimately, catastrophe happened. This is what happened in the oil refining industry. Oil refineries were not being built. Their equipment was rusting away. Their revenues just kept going up. They just kept producing more and more, and they just wrecked their equipment in the process. And so we began to have explosions in refineries in the early part of the 21st century, disasters happening, because they had not kept pace. Their revenues were great, but the core of the company was burning out. The same is true when a company's revenues are increasing and they are making their workforce miserable in the process. Getting rid of people, making the people there increase their productivity. Productivity is increasing. Well, great, that's a law of physics. But at the same time, ultimately, you're going to crash your employees and disaster is waiting way down the road because you were penny wise and pound foolish. So I'm happy to see the revenues rising, but I want to see more before I can say this is a company that has that I put a buy on. Next thing that we'll do is that cost of revenue. How is that doing? Okay, let's take this. Let me copy this down here. And of course, we get rid of the divide by zero columns, rows. Okay. Their revenues went up 23.16% on up to 30.26%. Costs rose from 22.35% growth to 31.33%. Right there, a little bit of a concern to me, because their revenues in the last period went up 30.26%, but their costs went up, their direct wholesale costs, if that's the word you want to use, went up a little more than that. So there's a concern that they were not containing their costs. They were not pacing their cost of revenue with their revenue growth itself. Little bit of an issue there, not much. Now, gross income. Revenue minus cost. This is how much of every dollar. Now, we're going to do a little quick, dirty one over here. The revenue minus the gross income over the revenue for 2014 31.8%, 31 cents, 31.8 cents of every dollar that they brought in survived paying directly for what they brought in. That's what you can how you can think of it. How much of every dollar of revenue survived the wholesale cost of getting that dollar? So there's there is what happened in 2014, fiscal 2014. So now we do the same thing equals that divided by that for the next year. Oh, 32 cents. Good. More of the dollar survived. And finally, keep in mind 32.3 cents. We'll do it one more time for the last fiscal year reporting equals that divided by that. Oh, they slipped again. You see it? It's a mixed story here. The numbers look good when you first look at them, but it's a little bit more of a mixed story when you... This isn't dramatic. Don't get me wrong. They're staying in a contained zone. But still, that was a... They managed to have a better performance in fiscal 2015 than they did in fiscal 2016 with respect to wholesale versus retail earnings. Now, these are down below this. See this? Marketing, technology, general and administrative. Those are the costs you can't exactly tag to a dollar of revenue, to your dollars of revenue. Things like sales and administrative, general and administrative, that's probably your wages and salaries, and there are a lot. Your light bills, your mailing expenses, meals and entertainment, your phone bills, internet, all that kind of stuff. Technology and development would be the expensing of, in the current period, of your overall spending on R&D. Marketing, that again. What you can expense in the current period of what you've been doing to get your product out there, get it known, get people to buy it. Now I'm going to put in a line, I'm going to say, put something right here. See this line, operating income? The other name that you'll see for it is EBIT, earnings before interest and taxes. Matter of fact, you'll see me more likely use EBIT. It's the same thing as operating income. It is how much money survives all of your normal business expenses. It's how much money survives all of your normal business expenses. In other words, in fiscal 2014, if I take operating income divided by revenue, 7 cents of every dollar of revenue survived all of your business expenses. 7 cents of every dollar. In 2014, or I'm sorry, in fiscal 2014, ow! Did that just happen? That's not. Do you see that? In fiscal 2014, they 7 cents of every dollar survived. In 15, only 4.5 cents survived. Well, that certainly gets your attention. Let's see if they recovered in fiscal 16. Equals 379,793 over 8.8 billion. Oh, isn't that interesting? Well, that certainly does give you, make you pay attention. Okay. Anyway, interest expense. We are really interested in interest expense. In this case, we're going to do a ratio called times interest earned. Times interest earned. And by the way, I'll cover these again on Thursday. I'm getting you the feel, which is what I really care you know about. It's how you interpret this. Times interest earned, I'm going to take the earnings available to pay interest divided by the interest paid. For fiscal 2014, they could pay with the money that was available to pay their interest expense. They could pay their interest expense eight times over. Eight times over. Here's first things first. You never want that to go below one, because if it goes below one, your company is gone. You have to pay your debt holders. If you don't have enough money to do that, they will shoot your dog, sell your Bible on Craigslist, and make your mother wear furry costumes. They will destroy you. That is the way that an immortal thing called a corporation dies. They don't have enough money to pay their debt holders. Let's look at what happened in years after that. Equals, if for 15, that over, this will come out to be a negative, it's not. 2.3, oh, it wasn't quite as good. They had it only 2.3 times over. And then the next year, these should be absolute values. I'm just not going to write it. That over that. 2.5 times over. So in other words, they had a dramatic drop in how many times over they could pay their interest expense. This is because Netflix went on a borrowing spree a couple of years ago. They went on a borrowing spree. We're going to talk about that, and we're going to do heavy, deep analysis here in just a minute. Take you right into the mouth of the beast. So now that we got to this one, income before taxes, we call this one EBT, earnings before taxes. You'll see it. You'll see me here. You'll hear me say EBT. That means that that's how much money they have remaining after they've paid all of their bills, including their interest, but not their taxes. And then they subtract out the tax line. This is a dodgy line because there are all kinds of things like tax loss, carry forwards, fun things. You have to actually look at statement of cash flows and look at the notes to the financial statements to see how this number was formulated. But here at the bottom is net income. Earnings, sometimes we call it. It is how much of every dollar, how much money is left that belongs to the shareholders. This is the size of the residual claim. The residual claim is what the shareholders get. It is what is left after the debt holders have made their prior claim. The debt holders, all those people above net income, your bond, the people who lent you money, the government for its taxes, your workers for their wages and salaries, your outsourced stuff, your wholesalers. They have the prior claim, and if there's anything left, that's the residual claim. That is what the shareholders get. They can get it as dividends, and or they can get it as plow back. The company can plow it back into the operations to grow the company. It's the residual claim. Now, the last one I'll show you is the net margin here, the last ratio for right now is the net margin. All you do is you take your net income, your earnings, divided by your revenue. In other words, for fiscal 2014, the shareholders got 4.8 cents of every dollar the company raked in revenue. In 2015, the shareholders had the residual claim of, oh, what? Really? 1.8 cents. And if, let's hope that number went up a little bit. $0.02. Well, let the good times roll. That's, you see, the numbers themselves can look kind of nice, but when you do these ratios and these percent changes, well, then it gets to be a little bit different story. You can see that behind the curtain, what's going on. Now, don't get me wrong. You can't say, well, there's a great number for the net margin. That's what I just calculated was called net margin. Well, it should be this number. Now, there are some industries where the net margin is like 0.75, 75 cents of every dollar. Some service industries are like that. Service companies where they don't have hardly any overhead or expenses, they'll have net margins 0.75, 0.60. Massive industrial companies oftentimes have very small net margins. A penny is not unusual in one of the massive oil corporations. But because their revenues are in the hundreds of billions of dollars, a net margin of a penny per dollar means the shareholders are doing really well. Understand this. This principle applies to many businesses. A lot of entrepreneurs, younger people, oftentimes they come to me and they say, well, I've got this idea. I'm going to make a pile of money real fast. This will sell like hotcakes, and every one of these products, it costs me this much and I make this much. It's incredible. They're going for the Hail Mary. Now let's talk about what companies Wall Street likes. Some of them are not Hail Mary companies. In other words, a company where they have some product they can sell for millions of dollars on costs of thousands. Talk about a company like Aldi's. Madam, do you shop at Aldi's? Sometimes? I do, but I am offended that I have to give them a quarter so I won't steal their cart. Seriously? And they put your food in boxes on the floor. Now another one, a Dollar Tree. Now that is a great company. $10, 10 gifts for Christmas. How can you go wrong with that? Okay? Think about a company like a Dollar Tree. A Dollar Tree might sell 100 products in a day. So their revenue for the day, without the sales tax included, would be $100. Including wholesale, they can get it really cheap. Most stuff comes from other countries. It's really cheap. They have to pay the light bill. They have to pay for the workers for the day. They might have costs for the day of, let's say, $90. So their net on any given day in a store would be a lousy $10. Who would ever, ever want to be an investor in a company like that? Well, I would. If you multiply that by, let's say, 5,000 stores, $10 net per day on 5,000 stores is $50,000 per day. Times that by 360 days per year, that they're open, and you've got an $18 million enterprise per year, and it's distributed. If one store burns to the ground, it doesn't damage anything about the entire chain. It is risk spreading. And these kinds of enterprises have historically been the big winners. Think about some of the great family fortunes. The company made little tiny candies or toys, a couple of pennies a piece. They cost a fraction of a cent a piece to make. But even at that, you might clear a penny on each piece of candy. You make 500 million pieces of candy a year and sell them to kids who want tooth decay, and you have got a family fortune made, like a Kraft family fortune. You see, the Hail Mary sounds like the great way, but that's wonderful. The throw the pass all the way down the field and touchdown in one play, that's not how the big teams of the old days won. They won 3 yards in a cloud of dust, one play at a time. That's how businesses sometimes work. So don't have a fit if it's not a great net margin. It could be the case that because the scale of operations is so intensely large, that the shareholders are going to do just fine in a company like this. In fact, sometimes I concern myself when I see large net margins. What are you missing here? How are you going to survive in the long run? You've got three customers that make all of your money. Well, gee, what happens if one of those goes away? But if you've got, let's say 15 million customers and you don't make much off each one of them, you've still got a winning enterprise. So there you are. Let me take you over here, just real quick. Okay. Now, like I said, you can plow through these. Ah, here we go. No, that's not what I want. This is the statement of cash flows. But I want to get over here to the balance sheet first. Okay, now, here was the thing, though. You have only 2 years of data here. Balance sheets, we used to get a lot more years of data. So you might have to go back to another 10K to fill in a year here. And I really don't know when this happened, because I am sure that back in the time when I was doing these filings, we had to do 5 years of income statements if 5 years existed, and 3 years of balance sheets, I thought. I mean, maybe I'm clouded on this. But anyway, we can still see. Look at the cash on the balance sheet. That is an insane amount of cash. You see, cash is a problem. Because on the one hand, you want cash to pay bills, readily available. But let me ask you this. Do you have $1.4 billion in your pocket? No. You'd have to have a bigger pocket, obviously. But at the same time, that's an awful lot of money, because you see, short-term money, you can't earn, you're not earning anything on it, really. It's only when you put money to work in hard, long-term investments that you really make any money off stuff. So if they're sitting here on this pile of cash, that's a worry to me. Well, where did that cash come from? Well, I can see that pretty quickly. Now, if you had seen 2014's balance sheet, you would see this even more clearly. Long-term debt. They had only a little bit in 2014, but now their long-term debt is skyrocketing. They issued notes. I think it was like $1.1 billion in notes. And what have they done with it? Most of it they have just sat on. They've plopped it down, and it's sitting there earning hardly anything because it's cash. It's highly liquid, wonderful, but that also means it doesn't return investment. Now, if you go back here to the statement of cash flows, you can see that, well, where did all that cash, where, if you look, they have spent some of it. Is this the statement of cash flows? Yeah. Investing activities. I can see here where they've been spending money. See how they've been spending money? Real cash. That's why it has gone down quite a bit. But still, wow. That's a streaming content assets. Holy cow. All $3 billion more in streaming content assets. So they're spending a lot of cash, but at the same time, and other assets, yeah, you can see they're spending. See how they're spending money? Year over year, they spent money here, they spent money here for the buying short-term investments. That's probably movies and stuff, rights and all that. But I mean, there is a lot of money being spent. Now we go back here. Just look at it. All of this cash, they borrowed lots of money, long-term debt. See how it's just huge and skyrocketing? What are they thinking? Are they stupid? Borrow money and then just keep it in your pockets? Why would you do something like that if you weren't stupid? Can you think of why you would do that? You got anything for me? Want to try? Go ahead. Talk to me. Yeah, you're paying a lot more interest than you are earning interest on cash. Short term, it would be almost impossible to generate much. I mean, you can make a few bucks in sweeps and commercial paper, but man, you're going to pay a lot more in interest for that money than you're getting, because they're borrowing long term and intermediate term. So the interest rates are going to be kind of steep, not horrible, but certainly more than you can make on short term investments. You got anything? Okay, then what we're going to do. Have you ever gone, do any of you know First Sunday out here in this area? It's a flea market that runs every first Sunday. I've actually tried to sell my artwork at that. Most people didn't want to buy it because they're there for cheapo garbage and all that kind of stuff. I buy stuff there, just fun stuff every once in a while. But the thing, though, is, suppose, madam, you're walking around at one of these flea markets on First Sunday, and you see this, you know, crappy artwork that was hanging on grandma's wall and that kind of stuff. But you're trained as an artist. You had art classes. And you stop and you see, oh, God, they want $200. Oh, my God, that's a Vermeer. That's a real Vermeer painting. You look at it, no, can't. Oh, my God. You reach into your pocket. $20. You can't buy it. It's there, but you can't do anything with it. There's an opportunity that you missed. This is the thing that we think might be going on. Netflix has positioned itself to get something when it is ready. They want to be able to get it before someone else snatches it up. Essentially, you can look at that cash line. When I see something like that, the two words that come to my mind are war chest. They're waiting. What would they be waiting for? What would a Netflix be after that would need $1 billion for serious money to get it before anyone else, or instead of anyone else getting it? What would Netflix be aiming at? Yeah?
Maybe like signing a contract for a show or an actor or something. Maybe you get them before anyone else.
That would not require $1 billion. But they got enough money for it. Yeah, go ahead. There's one of the possibilities that they're aiming to go head to head. They need to get the money together, either to do it themselves or to acquire a target for live stream. They're clearly investing in live stream. You saw that in the statement of cash flows. So we can look at these. You got to do the numbers, but you got to get past the numbers. That's why we are financial analysts. We're not accountants. We want to walk past that and say the why. Another thing. Well, okay, first of all, yes, they could be doing it themselves, but they could also be looking for a target. Play the white knight or the black knight, one way or the other. They could be looking for a target. Then we have to ask ourselves, who are they after? Because there is where the investment would be. I wouldn't be interested in buying Netflix. I'd be interested in buying what it looked like they were positioning themselves to hit. Okay, what else could they be doing? Think. Anything else? Did any of you watch? Yeah, go ahead. Oh, God. Yeah, VR is coming, and there's talk backstage about what... There are different names for it. One is experiential entertainment. And where they are, they're all being so daggone secretive about this. We don't know where they are, although I can tell you that when it comes, it's just going to be mind-boggling. But it's going to come at a price. You're all going to be zombies afterwards. Another thing, what else could they be going? Do any of you watch Netflix? Do you watch their TV shows? Yeah, they've got original TV shows. I've watched some of them. Some of them suck. Some of them are good. Stranger Things, decent. Longmire, they canceled it. Damn them. But anyway, what do you need to do TV shows? Well, license, what else? Basic. What do you need? You ever been in movies or TV? You need stages, sets, talent for the back room. For every actor, there are 10 to 15 who are back behind the scenes. Lighting, all of the different places that you will have scenes shot. That requires a studio. Could they be after a studio? Could you name some studios that might be interesting to them? Do you know the industry? Anything? Paramount? Something like that? Distributorship. Are they looking for distributors? You see, the question is not if they are looking for something. The question is, what are they looking for? One way or the other, in order for them to survive, they are going to have to keep with the technology. With live streaming, VR, experiential entertainment, more TV shows, more original TV shows, because the more they offer, the more likely you are to stay on the Netflix channel. And that's the whole name of the game. That was why, years ago, they started doing the seamless transitions from TV show to TV show on regular channel TV. Because they didn't want you to get up and turn the channel. They would fold one show right into the other without a commercial break. They get you into the next show, and then they do the commercial break. Netflix wants you to be hooked on Netflix TV. You don't need to go to HBO, Showtime, Stars, or to the regular channels. Or maybe they're trying to get a regular channel and put that into their fold. Or one of the other cable entertainment networks. Or maybe a sports network. One way or the other, you don't just sit on $1.5 billion in cash because it's wasting away. They're not earning. So they're definitely got, they have something in mind. The question is what? And then the next question is, can I get a leg into that, invest what they're after before everyone else figures it out? That's the name of the game in investing at the hardcore level. Okay, going through this again. One thing I want to point out here is this is total stockholders' equity. These are numbers called book value. This is book value of the company's shareholder position. But I want to get, so just make sure you know that that's not a real number. The real number is the market cap. But let me get it back up here and talk right away about debt. And go back over here. Whenever I have, I wanted to get back to the consolidated statement of operations. Oh, there it is. Okay, remember that liquidity ratio that I was so excited about? How many times over can they pay their interest expense? We never want that to go below one because that means the company is dead. The debt holders are going to take it. Debt holders could be bondholders, the wages and salary people, their suppliers, something like that. If they can't pay their interest expenses and all their other debts, they're dead. So the point is that that times interest earned, which is your earnings before interest and taxes, in other words, operating income, over your interest expense. We do not want that to go below one. You don't. So the higher it is, the better? No. And this is where we get into theory and practice of the firm's asset and debt management. A company that has a very high times interest earned, in other words, has many times over the money it needs to pay its interest expense. That's not a good sign. Debt is risky because if you don't pay it, the debt holders will wreck your corporation. But at the same time, debt is how you benefit the shareholders. Simply because the more of other people's money, OPM, we use, the more we magnify the return on equity. ROE, return on equity, is your net income divided by shareholders' equity. If I need to generate net income by new investments, if I want my net income to go up, I've got to invest more money. The company will not grow itself. Now, I could issue more common stock to put into plant and equipment fixed assets. That would make the denominator get bigger, and therefore ROE would fall. But if I can keep from selling more stock, diluting my shareholders' position, I can make, by borrowing money, I can make net income rise while keeping shareholders' equity the same. And therefore, my return on equity, what my shareholders are earning for their investment, will go up. So in other words, if you use debt, you magnify, you leverage your equity. Now, there are some corporations that say, we never borrow. I've met people, I will never borrow a dollar, neither a borrower nor a lender be. I have lost more than my share of students over the years because they couldn't afford an college education and they refused to borrow money on student loans. They refused to. And so the rest of their lives, they were making 20 grand a year at best. You are taking on the risk of debt, but that magnifies the return on you as equity. That's what we mean by the gains to leverage. By using debt, you magnify the return on the equity position. So when I see a company with a huge times interest earned, in other words, they have many times over the money they need to pay their interest expense, I ask myself, why are you doing this? Why don't you borrow some more money, have a larger interest expense, and use that borrowed money to magnify the earnings that are available to the shareholders? That's a question that I would ask myself every time. Your philosophy of being debt-free, well, that's laudable. But it is not always the best business decision because your job is to maximize shareholder wealth. And if that means that you are going to borrow money to maximize it, as long as you don't go overboard and borrow so much you can't pay the interest expense, then go for it. Do it. Otherwise, you are not acting in the best fiduciary interest of your principals. So you keep that in mind. When I see Netflix going from eight times interest earned of 8 down to 2.5, that's a little worrisome to me, because 2.5 is getting a little scary, at least as far as I'm concerned, but that's my personal judgment. But at the same time, if they can turn that $1.5 billion into net income available to the shareholders, well, by cracky, they're going to do good. My question is simply this. When are they going to do it? This has been going on for 2 years. They've been sitting on all of this cash, dribbling it out for streaming TV and other things. When are they going to pull the trigger and use this money? Good for them. They got it available to get whatever it is they're looking for. But at the same time, I am a little concerned at this point. So is this a buy, a hold, or a sell? That would be your call. I would say it's not a sell. There's no way I'm going to sell stock in a company that's got $1.5 billion in a checking account. But at the same time, I want to see them start performing within this next fiscal year. That's all I have for you tonight. I thank you.